Wessex LMCs supporting you and your practice.
Okay, I think it is 1 o'clock. So welcome everybody to another one of our Practice Manager Update webinars. Michelle and I, as you say, we haven't been with you for a few weeks. So when we know we've been in very capable hands and with Lisa and the team, but it's lovely to be back with you again. So I'm Louise Greenwood. I am Director of Education and Training at Wessex LMCs. And I'm delighted to be joined by Michelle Lombardi, one of our Directors of Primary Care. And we know that Ed Rendell, one of our Medical Directors and a GP working in Wiltshire, will also be joining us very, very shortly. So we're focusing on the GP contract today, but we've got a few other things that we wanted to share. And first of all, I just want to share my slides. So I will do this first of all. So I just wanted to share something that I've written on a slide for you, but we want to acknowledge what it's like for you day in, day out. And I'm going to read it out because I think it's really important that it's as impactful as it can be. And our practice manager supporters have shared this with us. So life is really tough. Political uncertainty, really tight finance, unprecedented demands from patients. It's year end, added workload with the QI modules, capacity and access plan to complete, ICBs in disarray. There is massive pressure on practice managers with the upcoming lack of funding to even manage the increase in living wage, let alone pay rises for other staff. PMs are very much in survival mode. I don't think I've ever seen it quite so stressful and uncertain of the future. PMs are doing their utmost to plug all the leaking gaps in the ship and remain that calm swan on the face of it. I have two PMs, as I say, this is written by our practice manager supporters that I'm supporting, who are just struggling to find out which way is up. One has been in her post 30 years. I think this is the darkest place that GP land has been in for a long while. We were just chatting to our practice manager supporters and they just said, this is how it's feeling right now. And I think this is hugely impactful. And the comment was, but as managers, we have to keep on dealing with all of that and trying to keep everyone motivated. It is the most phenomenal job that you are all doing. And it is so, so tough. We have our practice manager supporters who are recruited by us, who live and breathe the same PM world as you do. So if it would help at all, please get in touch with them, one of them via our website or by me or any of us in the office. We also have our Space to Thrive groups who meet face-to-face and facilitated by one of our practice manager supporters. And that is over coffee in a hotel to chat and physically face-to-face be together. There's something about coming out of your practice and chatting with other people. And we know some of you get that brilliantly through your practice manager meetings. It's nice to meet people who aren't possibly in your locality. It's nice to meet different people, but also some of you don't have those meetings as you used to. Only you really know how it feels, and it's essential not to feel isolated at times like this. So we will do our best to help. It is really tough, but just know that you're not alone. So that's just something I wanted to share. That comes from the heart from our practice manager supporters. And so we will move on to other things now. But do share this slide with your colleagues if that would help. It might help sometimes to share it as a team because everybody feels the pressure. But yeah, we just know it's really, really tough for practice managers at the moment. I will stop sharing my screen now. Okay, and I think, Michelle, we're going to come across to a few bits for you. I think we're going to start on MMR, aren't we?
Yes, thanks, Louise. So the first topic we wanted to cover, as Louise says, we are going to come on to GP contract changes, but we thought we'd do just a couple of topics and then come on to that after. So this is in relation to MMR for staff, and we know that there was communication sent out that practice could give the dose one for their practice staff and that you'd be indemnified to do so. And this arrangement is in place until the 31st of March. As MMR is a two dose course, the next dose is due four weeks after the first dose. So wanted just to highlight to practices that where you have practice staff who are due the second dose after the 31st of March, they will absolutely have to go to their practice. That is the current guidance that we have. If they're due before the 31st of March, then the practice can give it where they're working, but you will need to reinstate the immediately necessary process as that only lasts for 14 days.
Thank you much. And I think you're moving straight on, aren't you? You've got another one. I think learning disabilities, I think.
Yes, so we believe there's been some issues with erroneous codes that are being included within the searches, which has had some issues with the payments that are being identified for practices and had an impact on that. We believe that that has now been resolved. So the information coming out should be accurate and should reflect the activity that you have undertaken. If this still is a problem, we've been advised to say that you need to contact your clinical system suppliers, who should then be able to help you with that. But it should be resolved now.
Brilliant. Thanks, Michelle. And just a couple of Q&As that have come in. So obviously I read out a list of things that are particularly pressurised, and a comment to also for those of us who oversee the PCN finances as well, the move to have all accounts year end to March. And we have got two sets of accounts due by the end of March. So that is incredibly pressurised, isn't it? And this is, of course, on top of ROTA's staff, sickness, all the other things that we know are just run of the mill for practice managers who are trying to keep things afloat. Sad to say, the only reason still in the job is the pension trap. But every cloud has a silver lining, because it is a good pension. So let's just think of that as a good thing. And also, we want you all to stay as long as we just need your memory and your expertise. So don't feel that's undervalued. It is hugely valued. IT changes being made are taking away our ability to be the data controller of our clinical system. I know EMIS go in and do things on our system, and there's no audit trail of system changes. That's interesting. I'm not really aware of that. I think that's really good. Thank you for bringing that up. We'll just take that away. I think I'll find that a little bit more, Michelle. I think that's an interesting thing that certainly I wasn't aware of. Just going down to the other questions. MMR, we're going on to now, Michelle. MMR uptake's been poor among our staff. So that's an interesting comment. What's the point of only allowing practice a short time frame for the MMR vaccine when it needs a minimum of 28 days? This will produce extra work on all the practices.
Completely agree, and we've said that nationally. We're hoping that this may change, but as soon as we know, we'll share that with practices. But currently, that's the current position.
And just to let you know, we do talk with all the stakeholders, so NHS England, the ICBs, public health. We do absolutely liaise with everybody we can to feed this sort of thing back, but it's very, very helpful always to hear it from the ground from you. So again, welcome, Ed. Lovely to see you. And we're going to go through the contract changes now. I think, so we've done this because we know obviously you can read it too, but we just thought it might be helpful for us to summarise it and add a few pointers. And that's what we've done. Michelle has obviously worked extremely hard to put these together. So I'm going to share my screen now, and Michelle will take you through these with comments from Ed. And as ever, please do feed in your comments via the Q&A box. It'd be very interesting to know where you are on this. So let me just be quiet and share my screen.
So whilst Louise is sharing her screen, I think, for all of us, the devil is in the details. So the information that we have is what has been released by Amanda Doyle on the 28th of February. However, there are no documents that sit behind any of this, which is a huge challenge. We're 2 weeks away from the end of this year and beginning a new year. And we have no detail. So we await that. But this is really a reflection of Amanda's letter, and to take you through each area or key headline from that, and to just unpick it and provide some LMC commentary. I think it's worth also just mentioning that Andy and Laura have recorded a podcast, who Andy and Laura are joint CEOs, reflecting on this, and which should be uploaded shortly to our website. So just to mention, this slideshow will be available on our website. So where it's underlined there for NHS letter, there's a link into that letter and also the BMA press release. So taking the key headlines, so we're going to start with finance first. I think this was hugely disappointing to see the offer that was made by NHS, not the offer, the amount that's been allocated, which is a 2% uplift to pay growth for GP contractors, salary GPs and other practice staff. We know that the BMA presented a well-reasoned case and requested 8.7% uplift, which actually was asking for a pay, wasn't asking for a pay restoration. It was enabling practices to stand still for this year. And I think every piece of information that was presented to NHSE, they couldn't argue with from the BMA, because it was all factual, it was well-evidenced, well-reasoned case. So hugely disappointing. We're in the same position. We're in another imposition for the third year. We know this is going to cause significant issues. I think Louise has reference some of those in the list that you're all facing for this year, with some incredibly difficult decisions are going to have to be made around what you can and can't do as a practice over the next 12 months. And also the national living wage is coming in. So without any of this, there's also that coming in too. So it's really, really hugely disappointing around this. It's also making a comment about that we're now outside of the five-year contract framework and GP contractors have returned to the remit of the DDRB. So we're really unsure what this means. Are they going to be, is the recommendation from DDRB going to be 2% or is it going to be different? We all know last year what there was practice staffing included and that there was a 6% increase and that actually the funding that was allocated through the Global Sum didn't cover this for practices. So hugely unsettling and awaiting a number of bits of detail around this.
Before we move on, actually, Michelle, can we just come to some of the questions that are coming in? Is that OK? First of all, what does DDRB stand for?
So the Doctors and Dentists Review Board.
And please never hesitate to ask us stuff like that, because it's really important that we always explain that sort of thing. And it just becomes, you know, we sort of talk a language that comes sometimes is not understandable. So that's a good question. The 0.38% uplift for population increase is 71 patients for us. Are we able to say no more patients after this?
I think that's a really interesting question. I suppose there is the option for suspending your registrations, but I think we need to take that one away. I think that's a really good question. I'm not sure there's an easy answer. I suppose my initial reaction would probably be no, but there is the ability within the contract to suspend patient registrations.
Yeah, I guess if you want to be contractual or not on this, but so within the contract there's the established formal closure of a list, so you can apply the Integrated Care Board for 6 to 12 months to close your list and say no more, or there is the informal closing your list on a shorter frame of time, but that's slightly more controversial, but we would be happy to try and support any practices who wanted to attempt that method. But yeah, it's a good point.
Thanks, Ed and Michelle. So why are they imposing an practice nurse when a practice may not want this? And it's not just going to take a clinical nurse away to do management duties when we already have a practice nurse lead. So do we know anything behind what the decision that
I think it's nursing? I'm not sure they're imposing. I think it's an option. So the PCN will have an option to look at an enhanced practice nurse role. The detail that sits behind that, we are awaiting. They've released, we're going to come on to that in a second, around the practice nurse role around ARRS. I think when we've chatted about it as a team, we felt that it potentially could be something like a diabetic lead or a COPD lead, as opposed to a management role. But I think the devil's in the detail. A lot of this we don't know, and we await the guidance around the network DES. But I don't think they're imposing. I think it's optional.
Okay. ICBs are reluctant to grant list closures for any reason. That's just a comment on us.
I've seen this different in different areas. So I have heard back from other areas where it's like literally everything is rejected. I work in the BSW system where there have been some, and I've been in some of those panels where it has been agreed for a period of time. So yeah, I think we'd be happy to help advise and support if a practice felt they were wanting to do that. And I think if the area you're in doesn't feel that it's doing them, then, you know, we're happy to have that conversation as well. But it is possible, and it does happen in some areas. It's never sort of an easy option for the ICBs choosing to do it, because there's the impact on the practices, and it's also a slightly challenging position for us because we represent every practice, so we can't take that one practice who wants to close and advocate fully for it, because we've got to consider the breadth of the practices. But yeah, it certainly should be an option, and we're happy to help if that's what something is being considered.
Yeah, do email into the office and we can certainly help with that. I've been asking for PCN list sizes to try and start forecasting, but they're not available yet. But previous years, January list sizes have been used, also close to year end, and no ARS funding advice as yet. Not sure we can say much about that.
I'm not sure we can say much. I think we just to raise it maybe with the ICBs as to why they can't provide that information. I'm not sure we can say too much about that one.
Okay, a couple more questions, then we'll move on. So having online consultations available in core hours is a key part of the CAIP 24-25. What about those practices who cap the amount of them per day for safety reasons? Do you read that to pass this section, you cannot cap them? Surely fair enough to limit the amount to a reasonable level. So this is all about safe working, isn't it?
So I think probably worth reflecting, this isn't a contractual requirement. So this is a separate element to your GMS and PMS contract. So you still have the ability to offer online consultations. It doesn't say the time frame within your contract. I think this question is really pertinent because actually I think as a PCN, you need to decide whether all the practices within the PCN are going to be able to achieve this and for the funding that's going to be offered. And again, what we're not clear on what this actually means in funding for each PCN. So I think there are some conversations that are needed within the PCN and the practices to decide whether you're going to be able to A, achieve that, and B, whether you want to, and whether it's worth financially for you to do so.
And again, I think it's what you don't know. So again, in BSW, I think it's shifted a little bit over the last couple of years, but certainly there was a point where I was looking at other areas and thinking, why, what's going on there, where there seemed to be like almost 24/7 online access for patients in Hampshire. And then in BSW, it's sort of like, well, you had to put something on your website, which sort of served that function. I think if you're in wanting to turn the dial on that, again, we can advise on that. And I think don't feel that you, unless Matt spotted something we haven't in the next year's bit, don't feel, certainly at this contract regs at this point in time, you don't have to have a online service 24 hours a day open for your population. So it's deciding, some practices might choose to do that and say that's exactly how we want to work, but it's if you feel you don't want to do it, then there are other options available.
Lovely, thank you. We'll move on with questions in a minute. Do keep coming them in, but I think that Michelle will go back to you for a few more slides.
I did promise, sorry, I was slightly away. I did promise Michelle I'd comment on finance slightly. So I suppose the only other thing I wanted to say on this is a hard thing to say, but you said it earlier, Louise, the silver lining. I think there's such a squeeze on finance. It's finally getting some of the stuff out that we've been talking about for a little while. So I guess it's early shoots, but the finance is so squeezed. Where do you look at? So we're saying the postulation from the BMA is you need 8.7% to maintain services at this point. Where can you affect the financials? You could try different things, but you've got the 6% uplift from last October, which for most practices wasn't fully funded and caused a pressure. You've got the national living wage uplift, and I heard someone quote 10% is going to be the uplift for those staff. And then where does that leave the rest of the staff in terms of not being all bunched together? So there's huge financial pressures. I think the only thing we're seeing is that if that's fairly fixed and you can't do much about it, you're left either with the choice of running at a financial loss or looking at reducing staff. But I think the interesting bit is people are looking at the workload. And I think there's some estimations that it's around 20% of workload is not funded for or commissioned for in general practice. So you've got commissioning gaps where there's just no one's supposed to do it. You've got items that are in other people's contract. They're supposed to be doing it for, it's contractually, but it gets past the general practice. And also just thinking about, what are you doing, this level of service for the public, if that makes sense, of how much you're looking at and how much you actually need to do contractually. I guess that pulls into BMA safe working sort of concepts. So I think on those issues, there is some green shoots of people saying, well, actually, I don't really want to cut our finances moving forward, that's going to be unviable. I don't really want to cut staff. And there's actually a bit more of movement on people saying, we're not going to carry on doing the 20% of workload we've done where we're not due to be doing. And I think the pattern we're seeing is practices looking that in groups of practices and putting a position out and saying, well, that's it. Okay, we're not doing that anymore. And that is the, this concept of alignment and sort of organizationally looking at. So I guess that's the only silver lining with this, but I think that's an interesting area to watch with all this, such a pressured contract. Will it result in some chains of activity and a slightly more defined boundaries of what we're doing organisationally?
Thanks, Ed. And I think it's, sorry, Louise. I think it's worth just also mentioning that we do have a costing a service spreadsheet. So I think practices may want to start thinking about the additional services, enhanced services, et cetera, that you're asked to provide, and whether these actually are costed and a well-costed model, and that you're able to provide without running at a loss. So I think we might just include the link with this presentation on our website. I think that would be helpful.
Yeah, we'll absolutely do that, Michelle.
So we really just wanted to highlight, in light of all of, in light of the financial position and the contract offer that has come from NHS England, it's useful just to highlight the BMA referendum, and that there are some webinars that are being organised to talk through the contract offer and the roadmap for the next few months ahead. And there are three there that we've listed. So there's one on Wednesday, the 13th of March, which is today, this evening at 7:30. There's one next week on the 20th at 12:30, and 20th. We've got that twice in there. We need, that's probably different areas. So one South Central and one South West. And you can dial into either one of those. And then some other catch ups on the 21st of March at different times, if you feel that would be useful. So it's really just encouraging practices to dial into these, to listen to the BMA as to what their proposals around their next steps are. These aren't being recorded, so absolutely would encourage practices to go in and listen to what's being saying. So the referendum opened last week and closes on the 27th of March. This is only open to BMA members. So if practices, if GPs want to have their say around the offer and help inform the conversations that go on next, we would really encourage GPs to consider that, and can do temporary registration, I believe, in relation to that. And if they want to join, they need to join before the 21st of March to enable the voting in the referendum. Ed, I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to add.
I was just looking at the dates, because I think we've got so the time is the issue, I think, on the so South Central is Wednesday 20th of March, as is South West, but the South West one is 7:30 to 9 o'clock.
Details. Yeah. Okay. We'll amend that. My apologies. And we'll make sure that the correct timing goes out.
But I think, you know, I think the BMA field people are joining. I think even they are advocating this concept of join for a while. You want to have a voice, if that makes sense, to listen to the options to vote on the on this contract with the referendum, and then see how the development goes. So we're not the BMA, we're not a trade union, we're not advocating either route, but we're just giving you the information so you can decide if that's something you might want to do or not.
Okay, so coming on to QoF. So in the guidance that's been issued from NHS England, they're saying they're streamlining QoF and reducing bureaucracy. I think when we look at this as a team, I think there are some that may have an impact, but I think overall, we're not overly convinced this will have a big impact for practices. So 32 indicators out of a total of 76 will be income protected. So what that actually means is that there are 212 QoF points out of 635 points that will be protected. And most of those, we'll come on to the detail in a second, are around the registers, which actually practices have to undertake anyway, because actually you wouldn't achieve any of your other indicators around the specific areas. And I think they actually income protected it last year too. So this is not that, those are not new. The one positive is the aspiration payments will increase from 70% to 80%. And I think they're recognising cash flow issues for practices. How much impact that will be, we're not clear. I suppose the only caveat with that is if you don't achieve the points, then potentially you may have a recovery at the end of the year. But that could be a positive. And then finally, the indicator, so cholesterol O2, is going to be updated to be in line with the new NICE guidance from April. Next slide, please. So what we thought might be useful would be just to highlight the areas, the indicators that are income protected. I'm not going to go through these in detail. It's really just so that you have that information available to you when you're looking at it as a practice, and then you can make a decision as to whether that will be a positive impact for you. I will just highlight registers. So there are 81 points associated with registers. As I've already mentioned, that was something that was in last year, but you have to do anyway. And then the QI indicators, all 74 points are being protected around that. And then some funding being put into the capacity fund. Next slide, please. These are the final indicators that are going to be income protected. I think, interestingly, what does income protection mean? I think that's the key question. And what year are they going to base it on? Again, we await all that detail, because the QoF guidance document that is usually released we are still awaiting.
I think for me, just on the last one, it's don't forget prevalence still. It sort of sounds good that the registers are sort of cough protected, but more than the points, the prevalence seems to change the income. So you may want to ignore that and keep working to make sure prevalence is above as high as it can be. I think it's sort of disappointing, really, because it was sort of want to be, you know, those registers are not as helpful as the other bits, but there will be some interesting bits in it. I think it's all the detail. So I would establish which year it is and then look at your local score and whether or not you're going to sort of go for it this year or not, and how you're going to reduce the workload if you're not going to do that. How are you going to communicate that? I think the complicated thing is also that we have had some success locally negotiating sort of quaff protection. So you just need to check, you know, which year that this national one's going to be in. It may be that it's from a year that's been quaff protected locally, and unfortunately therefore the level of protection you're going to get from it is not as great. So just looking at your individual circumstances, really.
Thanks, Ed.
I just take on what is prevalence. So that's just the numbers you have in your practice. So prevalence of diabetes would be the number of patients you have with diabetes, the percentage of patients you have diabetes. So you get paid by quaff by doing the points for, you might have a number of indications in diabetes to do, but you probably get more income by having more patients in that sphere. So rather than just chasing the points, it's worth making sure your prevalence or the coding of enough patients is as high as it can be.
Absolutely. You need to keep your registers up to date to implement that. Okay, digital telephony. So when practices enter into any new digital telephone contract, it must be procured through the national framework, and that is going to be a requirement in your contract. And there are going to be a number of different metrics that are going to be reported on for a national data extraction. At this moment in time, we believe it will be used by PCN clinical directors, ICBs and NHS England. We don't believe these are going to publicly be shared. However, that's the detail at the moment. And there are a number of these eight metrics: are call volumes, calls abandoned, call times to answer, missed call volumes, wait time before call abandoned, callbacks requested, callbacks made. And this is coming into force in October 2024. I note there was a comment in the Q&A that actually there's been a feedback from a telephony company saying missed call volumes need clarification around that, because that can mean many things. So I think what we'll do, we'll make sure that that's something that we feedback nationally, because actually we need to be clear on that. Next slide, please.
If I could just go on that last one, I think we're aware some areas or practices who want the digital telephony but haven't got it. So I think it sort of now would be a moment to make a clear point to the ICB that you need it at this stage because of the new contract, and we'd be happy to support that if we can.
Thanks, Ed. So moving on, so performance lists. So the flexibilities that had been implemented during COVID-19 will now become permanent. So doctors that are employed or registered with bodies designated by the medical profession regulations 2010 will be able to deliver primary care service without being on the medical performers list. So they're saying that guidance will be implemented shortly. I think it would be really useful to understand what this actually means and how practices may be able to look at this. And I think we just await the detail on this. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what impact that has for general practice. It may be that it's positive in that it enables primary and secondary care to become more joint working. But as I say, we await the detail on that one.
Thanks, Michelle. And it is just doctors, isn't it? It isn't nurses.
Yes, it is just doctors. Yeah. Because I think the NMC have issued guidance stating the temporary register they had is ceasing. I think it's either already ceased or is ceasing by the end of March. So I think this is just GP. This is just doctors, sorry.
Thank you. And there's just comment, isn't the knock on the performance list worrying if they can't see undifferentiated patients? I don't know if you've got any comment on that, Ed.
I was going
to
say Ed.
Yeah, I mean, I'm waiting to see how, you know, I think we need the guidance. We need to see how this means in, you know, it's something that was temporary and it permanent. I've not quite seen where this is. I think I think the Brett feel is that it sort of floods the market in some way, but I can't quite see how that is at the moment. I guess if it's a permanent change, then shifts may happen. But I guess at this point, it's I can see any condition because I've got a GP sort of license, and I guess it would be, if someone's coming from a different sphere, it would be, how do you select that group of people just to see that person? So yeah, I'm slightly confused on it, to be honest, about how this in practice will work, but it's definitely there and it's definitely permanent, so we'll just have to get the guidance and see how it moves from there.
Sounds like we need a bit more information, doesn't it? I mean, one comment's just come in: if they're not on the performance list, they won't have a DBS check.
I think that's, again, the devil's in the detail. We don't really know. We don't really know what the requirements are going to be. I would imagine if they're a doctor, there would need to be some form of check if they're seeing patients, and whether it would potentially be a DBS check, but who knows? And I think, again, we need the details supporting this before we can make any comment in relation to that.
And just going back to our previous slide and the comment that Ed made, that Dorset ICB are no longer funding cloud-based telephony. So if you are a Dorset practice and you want cloud-based telephony, you don't have it at the moment, would you suggest, Ed, that perhaps comes to us?
Or the ICB, I think. I mean, it's a known issue for us, and I think that was what I was saying. But, you know, as far as I can see, it was a national pot of funding. And I think it was due to be that practices got the funding to do it. So yeah, I think I would ask the question of the ICB, so what do we do here? So there was national funding for this. We were looking at a system where everyone got on it. Now it's in the contract. What are you going to do?
The ICB first, as well. And then we can help if you don't get the answer that you think. Michelle?
Probably worth just mentioning, we are aware of this. Because I think it's come in anonymously, if the practices pop that in, could just make contact with us. We are aware, and we've raised it with the ICB, so we're in discussions over that at the moment.
And another comment that's come in just saying, the ICB, now we cover four ICBs, so I don't know which one you might refer to, but it might feel like I might refer to any of them. The ICB have said they were going to be going through another reorganisation locally, which will have a 45-day consultation period, and it could affect who was around going forward. How much more reorganisation can they have? Will it ever settle, as we need some ICB continuity?
That's the question, really. Where does that leave general practice in communicating with an integrated care board, which has less capacity to do things? And I suppose, again, if we're taking Louise's silver linings, it leaves us with an opportunity to define what we wish to do in some respects. Some things you can't control in that method. So I guess the things like digital telephony we can't do, but I think there is a lot more that's within the gift of general practice by aligning to say, this is what we're doing about this in this area or that area. So there's less capacity to sort of referee the system, if that makes sense. So we're seeing that in some of the things we're seeing from secondary care that we're seeing coming through. And then there doesn't seem to be a capacity within the integrated care board to say, I'm very sorry, you can't do that. It's literally in your contract. And I think that creates a big question for general practice. How does it respond? I think it's probably, for me, becoming more adult about it and saying, look, we can't anymore say that, please, can we have some help on this? Because there isn't an entity that's got the capacity to do that. And therefore, it's looking at what can we control and what can we say that we want to do or not do in our area. There's lots of conversations going on at the moment in that sort of vein all over the place. So I think they're local. I don't think there's... You know, here on this scale, there's not like an easy issue where we'd say, as one, we're all looking at this at one point in time. But I'm aware of lots of conversations going on where practices are saying, right, this is within our gift. We're going to align and agree what we're going to do and tell people we're doing it rather than ask for permission.
So there's power and strength in working together, isn't there? And consistency and having one voice. So if you want to find out any more about that, ask Ed. Because that's something but it's a piece of work that we are working on as an LMC because we know how important it is. We will keep you up to date with those conversations as they happen. Thank you. Should we move on?
Yep. Next slide, please. So just a couple of things we wanted to highlight here. Registering with a GP. So I think a few couple of months ago, I think, at one of our PM webinars, we had, I think, NHS England come and talk about the new online registration tool that they've got available. And we've had some really positive feedback from practices in relation to this. I think we've also had some nervousness by switching this on could open up the floodgates. I think that's, I can completely understand why practices would be nervous about this. Also, where patients use different tools, as in not just the NHS app, maybe other, I think there's practice, there's patient index, that's not the right one, but there are other apps out there that practices and patients can access, and whether that the ability to do the online registration process through the different app that's not the NHS app will be available. But actually, this is going to become a requirement from October 2024. And then the boundaries are mapping, and that practice will need to amend their mapping on the EDEC that goes in on a regular basis. So I think some of the boundaries one, I think possibly practice will be familiar with, and some practice will be familiar with the online registrations. However, there are still some questions about the other patient apps, whether that would be a possibility.
So just go to the other questions that are coming relating to this particular thing. So does the new registration form feed directly into EMIS? It would be a step back for those practices who've got an auto system such as Health Tech One. And I think this was brought up when they came to demo, didn't they?
Yeah, I think this is one of the areas that could be an issue. I think we need to take some of this away and unpick it, because I think that was one area that it didn't integrate.
So from today's press meeting, the ICB is saying Hampshire is ready to go live with Share Care from the 1st of April 2024. We are one of the practices who have opted out, who Laura represented on an LMC basis. Can you advise, please? I'm not sure we've got the detail. We might need to personally get in touch with you, Joe, about that one. And then, I've got any nods from Michelle and Ed. So we'll get in touch with you personally on that one, Joe. I think that'd be most helpful.
But just a quick plug that we've recently put some Share Care guidance on our website. So understanding Share Care, which I think will be increasingly a topic of conversation in the next year. So worth everyone being aware of. I'll put it in the chat.
That's really helpful. Thank you. We're concerned about the online registration. It's about putting practice in the position of having to refuse more patients who are currently outside our boundary. But with a new system, we'll just be able to apply.
That's a statement, isn't it? Or is that a question?
Yes, I think it is a statement. And I think, are we happy that's accurate? I don't know enough about it. I'm just saying, is that can anybody just apply?
No, I think there is something around your registered area. I think what we need to do is unpick this further. I think this is given this is a contractual requirement from October 24, I think that's the one area that we could unpick and maybe put some details out.
Yep, that sounds good. That sounds like it'd be helpful. Is the contractual requirement to use the NHS version of the registration form, or if we have our own online form, is that acceptable?
I think it's the online. I think it's the online process that NHS England have implemented. So I don't think it would be practice's individual online forms. Again, the devil's in the detail, so we probably just need to clarify that. It does say NHS England has co-developed and new, so I think it is the NHS England process.
Registration forms have been integrating for over a year, but it keeps getting delayed. So there's obviously I think that this has come up a little while ago about integration and media. And last thing we want is a retrograde step, isn't it? Interesting. This is just a shared care conversation here. Interesting discussions with the ICB make it sound as if we're alone in opting out of shared care. So there's obviously just conversations that people are having there within their ICBs. But I think that we're aware of that and we'll follow up independently. But get in touch with us if you've got any queries on that. And as Ed said, we've got a web page on it. Ed, do come in.
Well, this is a sort of trigger for me, I suppose. It's sort of, I think that's a really good point by both Joe and Doug. Don't be alone. Don't be told you're the only one, because you're probably not. And I think I've been told that a lot in conversations around the primary secondary care interface, for example. So I think it is around the concept we said about alignment, but if not alignment, communicating with other practices near you to understand what's going on, mechanisms like this help, but shining a light on it so you're not in that sort of shame position of like, you're the only one saying this is a problem, and the system who can't cope with a different view sort of saying, it makes you into a funny position if you're told you're the only one and you're making a problem and you're causing a problem for patients. it's very unlikely, and we can help with that or reach out to others. And it's unfortunate that that occurs, but that does seem to happen as a repeated pattern. So it's about understanding what others are thinking, others are saying, and not being, if you are in that position where you're told you're the only one, I would advise checking that out in some way. So speak to us and ask that question, or speak to other practices, and it's very unlikely. And often there's a helpful further conversation for understanding how others feel about it.
Thank you, that's really helpful. So Joe's come back. Can we share via email or Teams who else has opted out? So would you suggest people get in contact with us if they're interested in furthering this conversation? What would you suggest?
I think that's tricky. I think it's coming through a third party thing. So I think it's difficult for us to name the other ones that are, it's a slightly tricky one, Michelle. But, you know, I think we have, so I think this is specifically Hampshire Shared Care. So I know of a number of different practices dotted around, but I don't know the geography so well. I guess it's, I don't know if there is a mechanism of connecting different practices in some way. Michelle, have you got any thoughts?
I think you're right, Ed. I think this is slightly difficult. I do actually think we need to discuss this, because clearly there's been some information sent out. This is specific to one area at the moment. Interestingly, someone else has actually put in there, how does one opt out, and can any practice opt out, or any specific, or only specific areas? So I think it all depends on how shared care is commissioned. So in our mind, it usually is through a locally commissioned service or a LES, so it's optional. And actually, Ed, I think from a clinical perspective, it's the clues in the title, it's shared care. So there has to be an agreement between two people and two clinicians that they're going to share the care. So I think it clearly has, I think, relating to one area. I think the anonymous comment, I'm not sure where that's from, but I think we need to take this away as a team and have a conversation about how we might support practices around the opting out bit. But opting out, I suppose, if you've signed up to an enhanced service and you no longer wish to provide it, you need to give notice to the ICB that you're in to say you no longer wish to provide it. I'm not sure whether the opting out is in relation to specific drugs, so I know that in some areas are quite long lists, and whether it's an all or nothing sign up. So I think this is probably quite a big topic, and we probably need to take it out separately, but happy to. We can see some names, so I think we can make contact with those people to have that conversation with and decide how we move forward.
I think that's wise. I think this is a conversation that will roll, won't it? We're just sort of starting to have it. There's just one final question's come in. We're a practice who's also opting out of the shared care. I've emailed the ICB to see what other actions we have to do when opting out, but have not had a response. Can you offer any guidance for those practices opting out and where the responsibility lies for letting secondary care know?
I think probably, again, because it's a Wessex-wide webinar, we won't get into the detail. I think the only thing to say is that we are pushing that if there's a commission service withdrawn, the commissioners need to articulate that decision and have a pathway to let the population know they've decided that isn't a priority and they're looking at a different issue. So I think we've been pushing that there's a role for the ICBs in that and communicating to the population if it's either not attractive enough to be taken up or the service is withdrawn.
Final comment, we've opted out and at the end of this month the contract is done and no longer our problem. Right, okay.
Speak to Doug, everyone.
Yeah, exactly. He's found a way of doing it. Right, Michelle, should I move the slides on?
Yes, please. So this is an interesting one. So it says the provisions in the GP contract regulations will be amended to explicitly require continuity of care to be considered when determining the appropriate response when patients contact their practice. Again, What does this really mean? I think it's interesting because it feels like it contradicts all of the messaging that's been to date around access, access, access. So and when we've looked at the guidance, we cannot see the ACCC08, the 2-week timeframe that was included last year, included this year within the IIF. So again, the devil's in the detail. It would be really interesting to see what this really means for practices. I think nobody could argue against, they would love continuity of care. It'll be interesting to see the detail. So Vaccinims, I think the key message here, again, sadly, is there's no change to the item of service fee. This continues to remain at £10.06, which is hugely disappointing. And there are some requirements that are going to be included around making sure that you share your information with the local child health information services. I think most practices will be doing that already. Improving data recording of vaccination for status for all patients, including those patients that have arrived over from overseas and also have unknown and incomplete history. Again, I would assume you're doing this already. So most of the changes for Vaccinims are there, but the most disappointing is that the £10 and six is not increasing. Next slide, please. Just a couple of other areas to mention, the workforce data collection. So I think practices and PCNs are already doing this. Unsure why there's a specific mention around that particular option. And then armed forces veterans, again, the contract's going to be updated so that practices have due regard for the requirements needed and the circumstance for armed force veterans when offering services and making onward referrals. We await the detail, but it may be worth just being aware. We do have some information on our website around becoming a veterans friendly practice, which may be worth reviewing whilst we await the detail on that item. Next slide. Weight management enhanced service. This will continue for 24-25. Again, the funding hasn't been increased, so it will continue at £11.50 per referral, and that they've identified the total funding of £7.2 million for that service. So next slide. So coming on to the network DES, as we've already said, the documents that relate to this haven't been released, so we're literally working off what the Amanda Doyle letter has said. So first thing just to mention that currently there are 8 PCN service specifications, and they're going to take the 8 and replace them into one simple overarching specification with greater outcome focus. Again, we await the publication around that. The one that won't be changing and will continue to remain separate is the enhanced access specification, and it will remain unchanged for 24-25. Next slide, please. So in relation to the ARRS, they are increasing flexibility of the scheme, widening the responsible reimbursable roles and removing role restrictions where possible. We wanted just to highlight that there is, we've obviously had a question around enhanced practice nurses. So this is optional and they will be included for the roles eligible for reimbursement. Again, we're not sure the detail around this, so I think that's going to be really important for practices and PCNs to understand what this actually means, and that they've got to be working at an enhanced level of practice with postgraduate certification or diploma in one or more specialist areas of care, which I think, as we've mentioned, probably tends to lend itself to maybe a specific clinical condition like diabetes, COPD, etc. I think it's disappointing that it is only one, because actually what impact can that make, and will they be quite isolated because they'll be the only person in the PCN with that particular role? So again, we await the detail. Interesting comment about PCNs will be able to recruit other direct patient care, non-nurse and non-director MDT roles if agreed with the ICB. Not really 100% sure what that means. So again, we await the detail, and they've removed the caps from the advanced practitioners that's currently in place for this year. Another change that's been seen, so this will apply for PCNs. You must have one mental health practitioner in place where the 50-50 funding arrangement is currently in place. Any subsequent mental health practitioners that are recruited will then be able, the PCN will then be able to fund 100% of the reimbursement through ARRS and not have to share the funding, even though usually the mental health practitioners are employed or engaged by the mental health provider. Again, we will see how that works. I think the most important one to highlight for practices and PCNs is that the mechanism that commissioners, so ICBs, had this year and have had in previous years, being able to redistribute the unclaimed funding for ARRS between PCNs, that ability has been removed by the from ICBs in the contract DES this year. Hugely disappointing. Really not sure why that has happened, but it's something you do need to be aware of, and that's one that we feel has possibly been slipped in.
Are you saying we have to have a mental health nurse in the PCN if we don't already?
No, I think it's more just saying that it's optional, but if you want to be able to use the 100%, if you want the PCN to fund 100% through ARRS, you have to have a mental health practitioner already in place with a 50% payment mechanism. Okay, moving on to the capacity and access payment. So the cap will continue for 24-25. And as we saw this year, there was 70% of funding that were paid to PCNs via the capacity and access support payment. And again, there will be no reporting requirements, which is positive, and will be paid to PCNs in 12 equal payments. The remaining 30% of funding will be available to PCNs via the capacity and access improvement payment. And this will be paid to PCNs in monthly instalments over the remainder of the year. It does say something about once all practices within the network have put in their components of the modern general practice access model. We're just going to come on to that in a second. So the capacity and access payments, so the 30%, these are the three indicators that are going to be measured, the practice is going to be measured against. I think the one we really want to highlight, and I think we've already talked a bit about, is the online requests, which Matt raised the question, online consultations being available for patients to make administrative clinical requests, at least for the duration of the core hours. So as we've already said, this is not a contractual requirement. This is a separate payment, and practices will and PCNs will need to decide whether this is something they want to achieve and are able to achieve. Funding allocated to the cap has been increased from 46 million to 292 million. Huge, significant increase there. So worth being aware of. And then the PCN clinical director will be responsible for providing assurance to the ICB. So impact and investment, investment and impact funds, so the IIF. So practices and PCNs may be aware that last year there was a significant reduction in the indicators from 36 to 5. And so this year they are going from 5 to 2. And the two that are remaining are the learning disabilities health check and fit testing. And the funding from the other three indicators, so that was flu and access, will be redirected into the capacity and access payment. And that will leave approximately 13 million worth of funding within the IIF in those two indicators for 24-25. And we've also mentioned, we believe it would appear that the 2-week follow-up requirement, that indicator, it looks like it's been retired. However, we will wait and see what happens with the cap payment. Next slide. So also just wanted to highlight that the PCN-CD role, apparently they're simplifying and refocusing the responsibilities. I think these four here cover a huge area. So these are the four areas that CDs will be required, will be their responsibilities, and more flexible funding pool will be created by rolling the CD payment and PCN leadership and management fund into the core PCN funding, which gives a total of 183 million. I'm not sure the impact of that. It might be interesting to hear what PCNs feel on that. But that's the update in relation to PCN CD role.
I made the mistake of on a CD call yesterday saying, I looked at the top bit and said, oh, it's like, it's good, the role has been defined. But I think the point was made that it's redefined to a simplistic, but yeah, it's pretty much everything. So it's sort of hard to say what you don't do with those four.
Thank you so much, Michelle. That is an amazing amount of information you've got through in within the hour. We've still got 5 minutes left. A couple of things have just come in. With the online registration form, I just did an application when I had checked I was outside the boundary, and it has still allowed me to make an online registration to a practice who's offering this service. So that's clearly an issue. We will do a little bit more work on that, I think, Michelle, won't we?
I think we absolutely will. I think we've had a huge amount of questions on this, which is brilliant. And I think we need to take them, and I think we need to do some work, because I think they all feed into different elements of the contract, and we need to make sure they're then fed. We need to answer some of the questions, and we need to feed them in nationally, because I think that is a real problem. If patients can continue to register outside of the boundary, what's the point?
Doesn't know. Absolutely. Dorset haven't redistributed any R's funding in 23-24. Seems like they're keeping funds that should come out for themselves. I don't know what the rules are for 23-24 funding.
I think they have the ability to do that process, absolutely have the ability. It's only this year, or from April onwards, that they have specifically said that in the DES. Again, I wonder if the person who's popped that comment on could come to us, and we'll have a conversation, because I think that's something we need to unpick.
I don't think, in terms of not doing, they would keep it as an ICB. My understanding, the POP goes back nationally, so I don't think the second bit is correct, that it would be kept in the ICB budget if it wasn't reallocated, but I may be wrong on that.
Okay, we will find out. So yes, do come to us and we'll find out a little bit more, work with you on that one. Finally, it also means that potentially no one else in the PCN gets new leadership and development. So that's just one thing about your final slide. Yes, potentially. So we've got 3 minutes. Any final summary words? Yes, Ed.
I was just to mention two other things. Just earlier, I mentioned about we talked about the ICBs and the changes and stuff. I think it's just sort of didn't really mention the individual bit of that. So I think, you know, we will know and work with a lot of individuals, particularly in primary care teams, who will be going through that process, and it's very unsettling. So just be aware of that in actual interactions with the primary care team. It's sort of individuals involved in that, what must be really unsettling when 30% of the staff budget is going. And then, yeah, the last thought was just as I said before, what are the opportunities here? So if general practice is being squeezed so much, what is it now allowed to do that it wasn't allowed to do before, because it was felt you can't really do that? Now it's so squeezed, where are the opportunities to say, in an adult business-minded view of this, we're going to do this and we're going to communicate and align? I think that's the opportunity with such a disappointing contract.
Yes, it's being adult, but being kind to each other. But yes, but it's important to sort of always defend and fight the corner, which we will absolutely do and know you will do too. Any final words, Michelle? You've done lots of words this afternoon.
I just think it's worth just reiterating. So in our newsletter this week, there will be details around the podcast for Laura and Andy. Dawn, one of our colleagues, as you will see each week we dial in, has done a really useful summary. So that document will also be available. The slides we've just gone through, those will also be available. So we're trying to get as much information out there. And once we know once we receive the detail that we're absolutely waiting for, we'll also do some analysis of that and share that with practices.
That's brilliant. Thank you. Final comment. ICB cuts are a concern. We need to make sure some of the work they do is not pushed to us, i.e. data collection. Yeah, that's wise words. So just a final mention that we've got our conference coming up on Tuesday, the 25th of June in Bournemouth. We would love to see you all there. It's so nice to have you join us in this situation, but face-to-face is even better. So we do hope you'll come there and network with your colleagues, enjoy hearing some inspirational speakers, and just have a good day out away from the office, which I think is really important. Finally, we will be back doing this again on Wednesday, the 27th of March to 1 o'clock. And we realise it's almost 4 years to the day we started doing this, because we started doing it in COVID. So that's just been sort of an interesting lesson for us. And we will carry on doing it for as long as it is useful to us. So, there's a couple more questions come in. We've got one more minute. You mentioned 20% of work the GP could be stopped. What are they? That's a big conversation, Ed.
Just briefly, so the reference to that is one of the integrated care boards. They had to do a response to the primary care access recovery plan. So that was from a document from the ICB suggesting that 20% of workload was felt not to be. But, you know, the big themes are commissioning gaps. So where there's no service and general practice has to happen, things are in other people's contracts, but it's unable to be enforced and general practice is asked to do it, or going beyond what you're needing to do for your populations.
Okay, thank you, Ed. And finally, another note, is there a time period to reclaim CQRS return discrepancies? Public Health have queried a return of hours from January 2023. It isn't for a considerable amount, but is there a time frame they need to follow in order to make a historical return claim? They wanted to complete the manual adjustment returns form, etc. There's a discrepancy. Can't we just own up to that and be done with it all? So I think we probably won't know the answer straight off our heads. We will take that back.
I think that's an interesting one. I think we've got the name of the person who's raised it. Happy to pick that up. Probably just worth saying that within the statement of financial entitlement, there is a clause within there that talks about recovery, and it applies both ways. So practice potentially can go back 6 years, but that does also mean the commissioners can do as well. Having said all of that, there are some public health specifics, and we probably just need to unpick that with the practice manager who's raised the query.
And that's just been underlined. I was on a call last week. They said 6 years to claim back on CQRS. So that feels like that's the time frame. So I'm going to say no more questions. We've all got other things to do. It's been so useful. Thank you so much for your feedback. It's been a really interactive session today. And it's been very, very good for us. We gain a lot from these sessions. So please keep coming. And as I say, we'll follow up with some of you on some of the information that we've asked for you, and say we'll do it on an individual basis. And also some of the big questions that have come up today, we will certainly take back. So thank you very much. Have a good rest of your week. Take care. Bye-bye, everybody.
Take care, all.
Yeah, bye.
Wessex LMCs, supporting you and your practice.